Welcome to Denver Community Church Online. My name is John Gettings, and I'm so glad you're joining us today. Whether you attend one of our Denver locations on a Sunday or listen online, our hope is to be a group of people who are a just, generous community, practicing love in the ways of Jesus. As you listen to this teaching, allow it to begin a conversation with you and God, you and the Bible, and you and your community. If you have any questions about this teaching or DCC, email us. And if you'd like to help financially support our community and our partners as we give away 20% of every dollar that comes in, you can text Denver Church to 77977. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, good morning. I think one thing we've all learned, is you don't invite Chad to a football party. I mean, you'd be a blast, don't get me wrong. Hey, just before we jump into our teaching, one thing I do want to share with you is that this afternoon at 4 p.m. at our Wash Park location, which is 3 miles south of here, in our chapel, we will have Question Everything. Many of you have already been a couple of times, and it's a time for us to come together, and we start by asking questions, and then we have a time of discussion. And one of the things that's occurred to me in our current cultural moment, where everyone seems to be just yelling at each other, is I think one of the things that's needed the most is for a sense that we feel like someone's listening to us. And that's one of the things I love about the space that we create with Question Everything is it's a discussion between all of us. It's not a time where I come with a prepared teaching. It's not a time where I come with a prepared lesson. It's a time where we ask our questions, realize that we're around other people who also have doubts and skepticism and real questions, and a time for us to discuss and listen and learn together. So we'd love for you to join us 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the chapel in Wash Park, just 3 miles south. I hope to see you there. So with that said, let's jump into our time of teaching. God, we come alongside one another, alongside you, in bringing ourselves this morning. And I ask that in these moments you would allow us to be fully present, to recognize that you are inviting us to look within. You are inviting us to hear from you, to explore what it is that we're not only bringing here, but what you wish to teach us. So we give ourselves to that in this time and pray these things in the name of Jesus. Amen. All right, if you have your Bibles, you can turn to Mark chapter 6. If you don't, there's a Bible beneath the chair in front of you or near you, and the page number on the screen behind me corresponds to that. If you've been with us the last few weeks, you know that we've been talking about what does it mean for us to be not only a just church, but what does it mean for us to live as a generous church? What does it look like to be those who practice generosity? And this morning, I want to look at a story that's actually pretty popular, whether you've grown up in the church or even if you have not. And before I read from that text, I want to tell one piece that was happening right before we read these verses. Jesus has called his 12 disciples. And we learn at the beginning of Mark chapter 6 that Jesus brings them together and he sends them out in twos, two by two. And he sends them out to preach and to heal and to talk about the kingdom of God, to be his representatives, we might say. We might say he sends them out on a mission. And so they go out two by two and then they return to Jesus. And this is where we pick up the story in verse 30. It says, the apostles gathered around Jesus and reported to him all they had done and taught. Then, because so many people were coming and going, they did not even have a chance to eat. So Jesus said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. But many who saw them leaving recognized them and ran on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When Jesus landed and saw a huge crowd, he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began teaching them many things. By this time, it was late in the day, so his disciples came to him. This is a remote place, they said, and it's already very late. Send the people away so they can go to the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat. But Jesus answered, you give them something to eat. They said to him, that would take more than half a year's wages. Are we going to spend that much on bread and give it to them to eat? How many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. Go and see. When they found out, they said, five and two fish. Then Jesus directed them to have all the people sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and fifties, taking the five loaves and the two fish and looking up to heaven, he gave thanks and broke the loaves. Then he gave them to his disciples to distribute to the people. He also divided the two fish among them all. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces of bread and fish. The number of men who had eaten was 5,000. Now I want us to do something as we sit here and consider and contemplate this story this morning. I want us to imagine as best we can, and I'll remind us of this as we go through. I want us to imagine that in this story, we are with the disciples. We are the disciples. And I say that because oftentimes there's a temptation that when we know the story almost too well, we can kind of jump ahead. And assuming that we know the point of the story or the direction of the story, we can also situate ourselves into the place that feels best for us, which oftentimes is the place closest to or the place that looks the most like Jesus. But the reality is that we're actually much more like the disciples. It's worth noting that in the Gospel of Mark, one of the themes of the gospel is failed discipleship, meaning the disciples miss the point. They don't get it. They speak out of turn. They do and say the wrong thing. And I would suggest that that's probably more like us. Would you agree? Okay, a few of you are honest. The rest of you are like, I'm not sure, which just points to the fact that you're actually a lot like the disciples. I want us to imagine that we are the disciples. And we've just come back after being sent out for the first time on our own with our teacher, our mentor, our rabbi saying, I want you to go out and I want you to go out with the power that I'm going to give you. I want you to go out in my name. I want you to go out and heal and I want you to go out and teach. And for the first time in their lives, they are the ones who are teaching. They are the ones who are healing. They are the ones who are in discussions. And then they come back to Jesus. Now, how would you feel in this moment? If you've ever had that kind of relationship with a mentor or a teacher, you know that when you do something that you're excited to share, you long to hear from that person, hey, good job. Well done. When you talk to them, you want them to give you more insight. You want them to give you more direction. This is where the disciples are. And yet, they can't even get to Jesus because it says so many people are coming and going, they keep getting interrupted. As a matter of fact, it was so busy, they didn't even have time to eat. And so they're hangry, we might say. And Jesus says, you know what, why don't you come away with me? Let's go to a quiet place, just us, just you 12 and me. And I imagine that several of them were at a place where they were tired, they were exhausted from having served and spoken and given and everything. They just wanted to get away. So it's like, yes, let's get away. Maybe then at least we'll get something to eat. And they have no idea about everything that's going to transpire. They have no idea about this story. Now, what's fascinating about this story is that it's the only miracle recorded in all four Gospels. Now, I mean, of all the miracles that are out there, this one's pretty good. And you can imagine that after Jesus was gone, that there were moments where the disciples would sit around and they would recall incredible stories about Jesus. And I guarantee you that this story was told and retold several times. And just like most human beings, I'm sure it began to get embellished over time as well. Like Peter was probably like, there was like literally like 75,000 people there. And like Peter, it was five. Nope, it was 75. Nope, it was five. But what's the point of the story? If you're a disciple in this context, what would you have stood to learn? What's the point of the story? Is it just like a really great story to make you be like, man, that Jesus was really incredible? Or is there something else there? If you're a disciple, why would you have told this story? Why would you have seen to it that it was written down? They're in this place with Jesus. They get away. They finally leave. And it says that the crowds see where they're going. Now, the reason this is happening is because the Sea of Galilee, if you've never been to Israel, you may hear the term Sea of Galilee and imagine this just vast body of water. The Hebrew people call it a lake. It's Lake Gennesaret. And they call it a lake because it's actually very small. You have no problem seeing right across the Sea of Galilee. And so when Jesus and his disciples get into a boat to make an escape, everyone sees where they're heading. And not only were they getting interrupted when Jesus was, when they were talking with Jesus at first, now all those people that were doing the interrupting bring their friends and are waiting for Jesus and his disciples when they land. If you're a disciple at this point, I'm going to suggest you may not be thrilled. You've left to get away from them, and now they're multiplying like rabbits. What is happening? And even though you may have had that disposition, Jesus has a very different one. It says he's filled with compassion, which means he's moved in his gut because he sees the people who are like sheep without a shepherd. Now, this phrase, sheep without a shepherd, is used in the prophets, the Hebrew prophets, quite often. And it's not used in a complimentary way. It's used to explain what the people of Israel are like. And it's used as a criticism and as an indictment against the religious and political leaders of Israel. It's used to say to them, like in Ezekiel chapter 34, woe to you, shepherds of the flock, for you have only provided for yourself and not for the sheep, and now my people are like sheep without a shepherd. When Jesus shows up and it says that sheep without a shepherd, they're saying he is seeing these people who are harassed, who are helpless, who are oppressed, who've been worked over by the rich and the powerful in their context. And he's moved by it, and he goes to them and he begins teaching them. He obviously had no concern for what time of day it was or what needed to happen or what was supposed to happen, because it's finally the disciples that come up and they say, hey, Jesus, it's late. And these people are bound to be hungry. So send them away to the town so they can go and buy something for themselves. Now, this is not a compassionate moment for the disciples. They want to be alone with Jesus. They themselves are hungry. They may even know that there's some food somewhere. Get rid of all of them. It's the right thing to do, right? And I love Jesus' response. He's like, you give them something to eat. And they're incredulous. Like, what? We're supposed to give them something? We're teenagers, Jesus. And it would cost 6 months' wages. It would be a half a year's salary to even provide for them. What do you want us to do? Go into the surrounding countrysides and buy all of this food for all of the people and then bring it all back? We don't have that kind of money, don't you know? You're like, they're from Minnesota? Like, now, what's interesting is the way that it's written, what it suggests is the disciples are saying to Jesus, and if we did have that amount of money, well, then we would totally, of course, go and buy all the food for them so that they weren't hungry anymore, which is a really convenient excuse. And it points towards the first opposition that comes from the disciples toward Jesus with regard to feeding this group of people. If we had more, then we would, of course, go and do that. If we just had enough money, I mean, of course we would spend it, but we don't have that kind of money, so we can't do it right now. And it's interesting that this is kind of actually a way of thinking in our world today. We don't have enough money, but when we get enough money, then of course we'll spend it. And what goes right along with that, by the way, is the assumption that for those who do have enough money, they should be spending it. They should be giving it away. And it's kind of a little bit, I would suggest, maybe a little double standard. I mean, one of the people that's like squarely in the crosshairs of this way of thinking in our world today is Jeff Bezos. Now, if you don't know who he is, he's the world's richest man. He's the founder of Amazon. And this picture was apparently taken in some underground evil lair. You're like, where's the cat that's supposed to be on his lap that he's petting? And then you look at his eyes and that little smirk and you're like, oh, he ate the cat. Oh my. Jeff Bezos' net worth is around somewhere around $130 billion. That's 130,000 million. It's wealth that we can't comprehend. And Jeff Bezos, it's well known, doesn't really give a lot of it away. Which you begin to go like, what? His net worth means that he makes roughly $2,500 a second, which means he makes $149,000 a minute, which means he makes $8.9 million an hour, or $215 million a day. He makes a lot of money. And some people are like, yeah, but his salary is only $89,000. Okay. He also pays less in taxes than anyone in this room. People do not like Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos just bought the Warner estate, a 9-acre estate in Beverly Hills for $165 million. And he just paid for it. That would be like if you make $60,000, that would be like you spending 75 bucks. The guy's loaded beyond comprehension. His net worth is the same as the GDP of Ukraine. And because that is the first time in the last 6 months you've heard about Ukraine in a non-political context, you're welcome. Right. Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post for $250 million in cash without blinking. He just has more money, as we would say, more money than God. He started a space program and just liquidated some of his shares of Amazon stock to the tune of $1.8 billion because he is the sole and private funder of Blue Origin, his space program. And what he wants to do with the space program is fly people to space, like fly civilians to space. And you know that the people who get on that rocket and do fly to space will be the most annoying people ever at a party. What did you do this summer? Oh, we went to Wisconsin. We love the weather this time of year. What about you? I went to space. Like, you can't compete with that. You just don't like those people. I mean, I could go on and on and on and on and on. Eventually, several years ago, he became like just getting publicly shamed because he wasn't giving money away. There was no paper trail. There was nothing. And so eventually, he took to Twitter. And he said to the Twitter sphere, hey, I've invested this amount here and this amount there. And now I'd love to consider some philanthropic activities. What do you guys think? Help me figure out where I should give money. And you're like, really, Jeff? It's not rocket science. And apparently you've got that dialed in. So we're just talking about giving away money. Just give it. So up until now, he's given away roughly $3 billion is what the estimates are. What's interesting is that's a very, very small percentage of what he's worth. But what's also very interesting is he's in the exact same ballpark as the average American. It just kind of is more in our face because of how much he actually makes. Carl Jung said something like, we hate most in others what we hate most about ourselves. And I wonder if Jeff Bezos doesn't just amplify the kind of people we as a culture generally are. I'll give more when I have more. Actually, research suggests you won't. I'll never forget a meal that I had several years back with a guy who was in his mid-60s, someone who in just the last 15 years of his life had really struck it rich and made a lot of money. But it was only in the last 10 years that he actually began giving anything. And we were in a conversation, and he was saying to me, no matter how much I make now, and no matter how much I give now, I will never be able to make up for the decades that I never gave a dime. I wish someone had told me when I was young to start giving. There was like this lament over all the time you wasted. And I asked him what woke him up to it, and he said somebody came alongside him and said, hey man, you have a huge responsibility. And he said, but I waited. Whatever our disposition is towards generosity right now, where you are, is what your disposition toward generosity will be wherever you end up. More than likely is what research teaches us. This is where the disciples are. Well, if we had more, of course we would do it. No, you won't. No, you won't. If we had the 6 months' wages, no, you won't. So they object to Jesus. And I love Jesus' response. He's like not letting him out of this. He doesn't say, yeah, you're right, 6 months' wages is too. He says, you know, okay, fine. Go and see what you do have. When they present the need to Jesus, he says, okay, what do you have? He doesn't say, well, how much do we need? He doesn't say, well, you need to go and find, how much do you have? Go and see. And so they do. And they come back, and they're like, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now remember, you're with the disciples, and the disciples are teenagers. Which means, and they're hungry teenagers, let me point that out. Which means when they come to Jesus, they're not like, oh, we have 5 loaves and 2 fish. We can't wait to see what you're gonna do with it. This is like, we have 5 loaves, 2 fish. I know you're Jesus, but that's not enough. Told you so. Everything in them is like, we barely have enough, and this is barely enough for us, and we're starving. How are you going to give it to everyone else? This is the second objection of the disciples to Jesus, and I want to point out, it's an objection that we largely live with every day of our life. It's the belief that we don't have enough, and because we don't have enough for us, we'll never have enough for everybody else. It's a lie called scarcity. And it's the operative story for us in our current culture. There's a wonderful book called The Soul of Money by a woman named Lynn Twist, and it should be like required reading for everybody in the United States of America. And if that's not a strong enough endorsement by me on that book, I'm telling you, go buy it and go read it, because it talks about our relationship to wealth and material possessions. And Lynn Twist talks about scarcity, and this is what she says. Surprisingly, in a world of overabundance, the conversation is dominated by what we don't have and what we want to get. No matter who we are or what our circumstances, we swim in conversations about what there isn't enough of. We live with scarcity as an underlying assumption. It is an unquestioned, sometimes even unspoken, defining condition of life. It is not even that we necessarily experience a lack of something, but that scarcity as a chronic sense of inadequacy about life becomes the very place from which we think and act and live in the world. By the way, we live in a time of unchecked excess and abundance like the world has never seen in the United States of America. We have more excess than any culture at any time in the history of civilizations. And yet the operative message that we encounter nonstop every single day, uninterrupted, is more, 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 more. I know you have this, but you don't have that. I know you have 2, but you don't have 3. More, more, more. And it bombards us nonstop. Martin Lindstrom is an expert in advertising and marketing. And he's done research on what this does to our brains and how we receive this constant input into our senses. And he points out that this whole marketing and advertising messaging is something that we are so accustomed to in our culture that we pick it up instantaneously, but we do it subconsciously. We don't even realize what we're taking in. And he says, and this messaging is everywhere. It's on the radio. It's on television. It's on the highways and byways. It's on the internet. It's everywhere you look when you're standing in the checkout line at a grocery store. It's everywhere. And the message is more, 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 more. You don't have enough yet. You don't have enough yet. You just need to get a little bit more. And it never stops. Not only that, but he says marketers target young people so that they will grow up with a particular brand, or they will grow up with a particular way of viewing the world. And he said, you can actually go to most people in America who favor a particular brand and say to them, why do you like that brand? Why do you buy that particular brand? And he said, and their response to you will be almost a perfect repeating of all of the messaging and the branding that has come from that company. We're soaked in it. More, 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 more. We are trained in our culture to not look at what we have and practice gratitude and arrive at contentment. We are trained in our culture not to see what we already have, but to see what we don't yet have, which tells us what you do have is not enough and you are not enough, but if you get more, then you'll have enough. The trick is the message never stops, so we never arrive. And if you believe that you don't have enough, then just like the disciples, you're not going to willfully give it away. Because there's not enough for you, there's not enough for them. This toxic lie of scarcity undercuts generosity almost more than anything else. And it's not a new phenomenon, because we see it with the disciples. We don't have enough. And if we don't have enough for us, Jesus, then how are we going to give it to anyone else? And you know what? We don't have enough now. But when we do have enough, well, then, of course, we would go to the countryside and the small towns, and then we would buy it. But we don't have enough. Jesus still does not let them off the hook. They come with an I told you so, or we proved it to you attitude. And Jesus says, great, good, thanks. Why don't you put those down? Now have the people go sit down in groups of 50s and hundreds. Remember, you're with the disciples. At this point, you think Jesus has lost his mind. Why are we assembling them in groups? Is that so we can tell them individually, like, we don't have enough food for you, so you just need to go somewhere else? I mean, what are you thinking, Jesus? Well, they go and do that. And then Mark uses very interesting language. He says, Jesus gave thanks, broke the bread, and gave it to his disciples. The identical phrase that is used for the Eucharist, which we're about to celebrate in a few minutes. That Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, took the bread, and when he had given thanks, broke it and gave it to his disciples. In other words, Jesus is saying, hey, don't forget the source of all of this. Don't forget the source of all of it. Because I have compassion on these people because I am the good shepherd. So what are you going to do? You going to be like the shepherds from the prophets who only feed yourselves? Or are you going to be the good shepherds that I said will come, who will in fact restore the fortunes of my people? Which one are you going to be, guys? Jesus takes it, gives thanks, breaks it, and gives it. And I don't know what was going through their mind. I can only imagine and speculate, as you can, when they took the first few pieces and walk to the first group of people. Like, oh man, this is going to be interesting. But I also wonder what began to happen when they gave the bread and the fish away. What did they see in the people's faces? What kind of words did they hear? I mean, were they like, hey, do you have any butter? I prefer margarine, lactose intolerant, you know, like. Or were they going, thank you, I didn't know we were going to get fed. We were just talking about going to the town next door to see if we could get some food. What went through their minds when they walked back to Jesus and were like, well, I just gave some away. I guess there's some more. What happened when they kept going back and forth and back and forth? Have you ever been in a group of people where everyone shows up at a restaurant to have some food together or at a cookout to have some food together and everyone's talking about how hungry they are? Have you noticed the conversation isn't really incredible at that point? Then you get some food in you and what happens? People start laughing and talking and relating because all the fuel you need is coming back. Is that what's happening in the crowds? And by the way, let's keep in mind there's 5,000 people there and scholars point to the fact that the only people that Mark seems to point out are men, which means that there was a lot more women and a lot more kids. So some say there could have been as many as 15,000 people there. Very few, it's safe to say, knew what was happening with Jesus. What they saw was a group of 12 teenagers going and giving food and giving food and giving it freely and giving it abundantly. I think there would have been incredible energy amidst this crowd of this is unreal. We didn't know you had this much. Thank you for sharing it. And I think that it had to have done something to the way the disciples see generosity. And I say that because of something that happened to me in the last couple of years. I had a moment where I was told about a need, and it was a financial need, and it was something I knew that I could give to. And when I was told about it, my initial response was, oh, I wish I didn't know about this. Because I knew the dollar amount. And I didn't want to give that away. I knew what I could do with that kind of money. I knew actually what I would buy with that money. And I had this internal argument on and off for days. I wanted to email somebody who was a part of DCC and be like, hey, I learned about this need and I want to give you the joy of giving. And eventually one day I was journaling about it and spending time contemplating about it. I just had this real internal argument. And in that moment, something shifted from what I have to give or should give or what I'll miss to what's going to happen when those people receive this gift. And I literally just began imagining what it would be like when they opened an envelope and what they needed was there. I began to think about the moments in which people have been generous toward me and I've opened an envelope and about fell over because I couldn't believe what someone had done or given to me. And all of a sudden I thought, how silly that I'm concerned about what I could buy when this is gonna like allow people to have a party, to go out and have a good time, to do something freely with their friends and with their family. I've been such an idiot. And I have to believe that when the disciples are out there and they're watching people eat and they're watching all this unfold, there was a profound sense of that. Oh my, we would have missed out on this if they had gone to the towns in the countryside. We would never have had the eyes to see it. And not only that, but what's fascinating is if you read all four accounts in the Gospels of this story, none of them actually talk about the multiplication. They don't talk about what Jesus did. And it's worth noting there are other stories in the Bible that are about multiplication where that's the emphasis. That's not the emphasis here. The emphasis here is the distribution. The emphasis here is that the miracle is that Jesus invites the disciples to participate in the generosity of God in meeting the needs of the people. They are the vehicle. They are the ones getting thanked. They are the ones seeing it unfold in their midst. Jesus is just off somewhere else doing something with the bread and the fish. It's even the disciples that pick up the 12 basketfuls at the end. And I have to believe that when the crowd dispersed, Jesus was like sitting around, leaning up against the boat. And when they came up with their baskets, he's like, hey fellas, what's in the basket? Like, totally just rubbing it in. I would have done that if I was the Son of God. Just saying. What's interesting is that numbers mean a lot in the Bible. There's 12 basketfuls. They're in the land of the 12, the 12 tribes of Israel. The message to the disciples is, hey, change the way you view things. The question is not how much can we get, how much do they need? The question is, what do you have? And when it passes through the hands of Jesus, it's gonna be enough. It's gonna be actually more than enough. It's interesting that in Mark chapter 8, there's another story of the feeding of 4,000. And there's 7 basketfuls that get picked up. And if you want to know what I think that means, join us tonight for Question Everything at 4 p.m. at the Wash Park Chapel. How's that for a commercial? Marketing, see? You need something, right? And you don't have it. Jesus is saying, listen, what do you have? It's enough. And I'm somebody who believes we actually all have something to give. No matter where you find yourself this morning, I genuinely, deeply believe every single one of us has something to give. Because I've witnessed generosity from all sorts of places. A friend of ours has a daughter who's 8 years old, and their neighbor is a woman who's in her late 80s. And this woman who's in her 80s, her daughter came to live with her mother while the daughter was going through a very aggressive form of cancer treatment. This 8-year-old girl, within a few days of this woman in her 60s who was getting the cancer treatment moving in, this 8-year-old girl meets her when she's walking her dogs, strikes up a conversation, and somehow pulls from this woman that she's going through cancer and cancer treatment. The 8-year-old says, well, can I come and visit you when you're not feeling good? And so this 8-year-old begins going to this woman's house and just hanging out with this woman who's going through cancer therapy, cancer treatment. And it was amazing. Our friends are telling us, she began writing cards to this little girl about like how you are such a support and such a lifeline and such a light. And they've become incredible friends. This 8-year-old didn't have anything to give, but she had time. She had compassion. She had a heart. She had ears. She could listen. She doesn't understand all that's unfolding in the life of this family, but she gave something. What do you have? A few weeks ago, I was coming back from a trip, and I was coming through Denver International Airport, you know, the place out in Kansas, and most of the time that I go to and from there now, I ride the train, and I swear to you, there is somebody on the train at the airport who, whenever they see me coming, they're like, go, 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 Michael's here. Because it's like right as I get up to the train, it takes off and leaves all the time. So I come back from my trip and I'm like walking toward the train. I'm like, gonna make it, gonna make it. And it starts moving. I'm like, son of a, and everything in me starts to hate the people that were in front of me on the escalator, you know those people who are like, this is such a fun ride. It's so long, right? I have like a big duffel bag in my backpack and I'm like doing like the, you know, airport shuffle, trying not to hit people. And I watch the train pull away and I swear I can't prove it. The conductor was laughing and I'm just furious. And all of a sudden I hear this woman say, there's gonna be another train, you know? That's not the good part, by the way. That's you laughing at me because she's right. So then she hands me a ticket and says, like, you'll need this to ride it. Everything in my disposition changed because someone was like, oh, this is a guy who clearly left the train or missed the train and I have a ticket. I don't know why she didn't need it. She gave it to me. What do you have? The first church where I worked, there was a guy who was really old. I mean, like, really old. He was in his, like, hundreds. His name was Calvin. And no one really knew what he did. They just said, like, oh, yeah, he drives around and, like, visits people. But don't ever drive with him. Like, it's not a good thing. He can barely see. So there was one day I was in my office. I was in my mid-20s, and he came in and said, hey, I'd love for you to spend a day with me and drive around. I was like, okay, why don't I drive? And so we did. And the first place we stopped at was a hospice center. And this old, decrepit man walked in with his little smile. And the whole family that was there and the woman on the bed all lit up. And he introduced me and talked. And then the next stop was an old folks home, a nursing home. And I do remember almost every person there was like, your hair is so dark and thick and... I think someone made a comment about a manchichi to me at some point. But when he would walk into these places, everyone would laugh. Then we went to a hospital. And I found out that what he did is he collected information from the church about all of the people who didn't get visitors. And he spent his days, day after day after day, just visiting people. No agenda. Just spending time with them. That's all he had. What do you have? One of my favorite moments when it comes to financial giving at Denver Community Church was not some of the really big big gifts that we've received, which, by the way, we really like those. It was when, after a Sunday, I walked upstairs to my office, and the people who do the counting of all that you give were up there, and someone said, hey, man, you got to see this. And they showed me an envelope. And I don't remember the name on it, but it looked like it was written by probably someone who was in first or second grade. And then they opened it and showed me, and there was a bunch of coins in it. What do you have? See, I believe we can all give something. And this is the invitation of Jesus. What do you have? He doesn't say, well, you should have 6 months' wages if you used your money better. He doesn't say, what do you have? Go and see. What do you have? I asked at the beginning, what's the point of the story? Why include it? I think the point of the story is that it's a lesson in understanding what we actually already possess, what we've actually already been given. And if we can see that and if we can understand that, then we can hear the invitation of Jesus to participate with God in God's generosity. We can hear the question, what do you have? Let's pray together. God, we recognize that all that we have, our very breath, is given to us by you, the source of all things. We recognize as best we can that you give freely and you give abundantly. In the words of Jesus, you cause the rain to fall on the unjust and you cause the rain to fall on the just. I ask that we would recognize the generosity in the heart of God so that we would be those who recognize that there is an invitation to participate with God in that generosity. And that invitation comes by way of a question, what do you have? Give us eyes to see that so that we might have the joy and experience the joy of working alongside you. We pray these things together. In the strong name of Jesus, And all the disciples said,